Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. This is Jason Fitzgerald, and it's August 15th, 2021. It's a late morning Sunday for me recording today. Anyway, you can find me at Jason_OTC on Twitter. You can email me, jason@overthecap.com, anytime that you want with any questions for the podcast or just general stuff about contract, anything NFL related. Nelly the Bunny is here. Nelly is a little bit more active, I think, this morning. Nelly, you got anything right off the bat here? Nothing. All right. But perhaps Nelly will jump in later on. I'm sure she will. I'm sure she'll be making some noise in the couple minutes I've been sitting down here. She's been doing that already. You know, not as busy a week this week. Obviously, last week, you know, we did the just a bunch of contract stuff came down. And this week, that's not really the case. So we'll talk a little bit just about some of the little stories that came out. But I wanted to talk more today, I think, about quarterback contracts. And then if there's time, just a little bit about planning in the preseason, just from some comments that I made on Twitter and just some feedback that I got on that. I thought it was just kind of an interesting little discussion point. I guess we'll start out with just the little bit of news section. And that really goes to the situation in Seattle, where you do have two players who are more or less refusing to practice with the team because of contract issues. Dwayne Brown is the starting left tackle in Seattle, and Jamal Adams starting safety. So I wrote about this a little bit, but then there was some more information came out. It was a article, Bob Condotta in I can't remember, and I should. There were two authors on it where they kind of gave a little bit more details of where the negotiations with Jamal Adams are at. I'll say this, based on what was reported as to where Seattle was with the latest offer to Jamal Adams and the fact that Jamal Adams was open to that number, that leads me to believe that that contract will get done maybe this week. The Dwayne Brown one, it sounds as if that is going to be a little bit more difficult. It doesn't seem as if they're really interested in extending him at this point in time. In terms of money, I thought that actually would have been the easier of the two deals to get done. Brown is unique in the fact that he's still a productive left tackle in the league, but he's pretty old. There's not a lot of real comparable players, but you could look at someone like an Andrew Whitworth. You can look at a couple guys like that, and you could say, okay, you know, the market for him should be around this type of number. I think when I wrote about it online, you look at a fair market number for someone like him. Basically, you come up with a number that's in the ballpark of $15 million a season. When you consider one of your options, if you're going to keep him beyond this year anyway, would be the franchise tag, I'd say $15 million is perfectly fair. You come up with a deal where the guarantee itself, really all you're doing is guaranteeing next year's salary. Doesn't matter what the length is on it. You can make the guarantee look a lot bigger simply because he's going to make $11 million or so this year, which on paper is not guaranteed. You throw a guarantee on that so someone can blast out there, you know, player X gets $26 million in guarantees, 27, whatever it might be. You can do that. So I thought that would be easy. I have a feeling that if they're not opening negotiations here with him, that they just don't want to extend him. They want to see where he's at this season, and that maybe the age thing is much more of a concern than I thought it was going to be going into this. That one is a little trickier. You know, I always say that there are players who basically don't hold out, players won't hold out, but he does fit into a kind of a rare circumstance. He is one of those players that did hold out when he just had a complete disagreement with Houston about a lot of different things, contract included, but it was a lot of stuff that was going on in Houston, and he held out for a pretty long time before he came back, but he came back pretty much with the realization that they were going to trade him, or they were going to try to trade him. I think he had to suit up one game for Houston, but I think they told him they'd actively shop him, which they did, and then they traded him to Seattle. Seattle ends up giving him the extension that he wants the next year. That'll be interesting to watch play out to see what happens come week one if he actually decides to go from refusing to practice, being a quote-unquote hold-in, to actually not playing, being subject to, you know, forfeiture and all kinds of other stuff that can kind of come down from that, and the possibility of a contract tolling if things go for a really long time. You know, it's a weird situation, and it's a little bit different too, because it's kind of rare that you see a player be in camp and then leave camp. That doesn't happen too often. Every once in a while, you may see something, I guess, like that happen, and this would be one of those rare instances where it does, in part because of that $50,000 a day fine kind of thing. That's really where this would have started. So that's one to watch play out. Now, the Jamal Adams thing, I was a little surprised. It sounds as if the offer that Seattle made is $17.5 million per year, four-year extension. That's the very typical Seattle deal. All their deals are four-year deals. They don't really do five-year, so it's a four-year deal. And it sounded as if the hang-up was a guarantee. They wanted to move the guarantee from $38 million, which came in from Seattle, to $40 million. And that seems like a pretty easy thing to bridge, unless they're talking about a completely different framework. What I would mean by a completely different framework is if they're looking for $40 million in the first 2 years and the $38 million on that guarantee covered, you know, the first 2 years of the deal plus a little bit more, you know, that would change things up maybe a little bit. But my assumption is it's probably not that far of a divide. You know, the safety market has not had a big positional reset. I don't know if it really ever has. You know, just trying to think back to, you know, who were some big players that really set the market on fire? And there really haven't been any. You know, the safety position, while there are a couple of players who I guess people look at as kind of being somewhat transcendent, and Adams falls into that category by reputation, probably not by impact. Those players haven't really pushed the market that much. You know, Eric Berry maybe did. Matthew maybe did a little bit. I'd have to go back and even see what those numbers are. It's probably not that far, because you had safety was a position that did this weird, like, kind of creep up. And then those two guys signed the deals, and then it was creep down. And then kind of went back up again when Landon Collins, who I think is kind of a comparable player to Jamal Adams. The main difference being Adams was a much higher draft pick than Landon Collins. Adams a better player too, but I think the comparison is kind of valid there. I don't know how Adams would do in free agency. Adams would not get $20 million a year in free agency. I think that's originally what he was hoping for. I think when you looked at the models that came from all these different trades, all those players are getting $20 million a year. He views himself as that kind of game-changing talent. There is something to be said for the fact that safety had kind of moved up to the cornerback level. Now, quarterback is so much higher that, you know, there should be a jump that comes from that. But if you look at Adams' skill set, he's not really a coverage guy. You know, he's had his moments at times, but for the most part, he's just a average kind of coverage player. He's good, you know, in the box safety, you know, good linebacker kind of type. You know, and you can argue that there's linebackers that I thought he would have, you know, that you've got linebackers making $19 million a year, so he could be viewed that same way. He rushes the passer. People make a big deal out of that. You don't pay a safety for rushing the passer. It doesn't work that way. It's no different than a running back who catches the ball and says, pay me like a wide receiver. Do you do that? No, you would never do that. You know, there's a lot of different positions, and people look at different things. It'll be like, well, you know, this guy is a tremendous blocker down the field. We're talking about a wide receiver. You know, he's a great blocker. Okay. Are you really going to pay that guy because he's a better blocker than Michael Thomas? I mean, it doesn't really compute. They don't really factor into the equation. It's a nice trait to have. It's a nice ability to have, but it's only going to be used, one, if you have a team that's willing to design plays that has a safety coming in as a rusher. That's number one. Number two, you have to have, I don't know, kind of these situations where it makes an impact. And for a lot of teams, it really doesn't, you know, to have that. You'd rather have your safety kind of working in the secondary. You know, if you have a reasonable set of pass rushers, you don't really need your safety to get you 8 sacks a season. You know, he stood out really as a pass rusher on the Jets because the Jets pass rushers were about as good as I am. You don't pay for those things. You combine that with the fact that Wagner was already at $18 million a year. There's no way they could go over him. I said that from day one, that the target price on him, I thought, was always going to be 17, 17 and a half, 16 and a half, you know, in that range. So if he's there, I got to imagine that this deal is going to get done this week, unless, and that this is the one caveat that I'll pull, there are veteran players who don't feel like doing training camp. Adams is a weird kind of guy with a lot of stuff. You know, he's very temperamental, it seems like, at least with the Jets. Emotional is probably the better word, not temperamental. Emotional. You'll see him right now waving stuff on the sidelines and everything. But I don't know. A lot of things seem to change day to day. I would not be surprised if there's a, well, you know, he's staying in shape. He's following along. He's watching along. Why get out there and get hurt? Chance getting hurt, whatever. Let's wait till training camp breaks and then we'll sign the deal. I wouldn't be surprised if that necessarily happens. But I would think a deal is going to get done if he's going to be happy with the 17.5. That's a pretty good jump from safety, which right now is 15.25. So that would be a standout. It would take away the risk of free agency where I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if he's going to be that kind of sought after. He will be, no matter what, the highest paid safety in free agency. But that highest paid safety in free agency might be 15.5, might be 15.8. I don't think it would be 17.5, or it might not be 17.5. So I think a 17.5 would really represent the best possible outcome for him anyway. You know, the franchise tag is low at the position. I think it's around 12.5 million. So it's a low number. So you don't have a lot to work with there, because from a team perspective, they can simply say, look, we're going to tag you two times. You can say, I don't want to be tagged. You can say, I'm going to hold out. You can say, I'm not going to sign it. All right, fine. You can sit, we'll tag you again. You know, Le'Veon Bell did that, right? I think the teams have a lot of leverage here. So I think this will be one that gets finished. And then I think the question is just going to be, does Seattle regret it? You know, I think you already regret the trade. All right. Giving away two first round picks for safety. It was a bad trade to start with when that was kind of your starting point. Now, I know that you're talking about late first round picks, and that is, I think, something that goes into the equation for them. And that they are a win-now team, you know, that goes into the equation for them as well. But two first-round picks for Jamal Adams was a mistake. I mean, that's something you regret. The thing is, do you regret the contract as well? Does Jamal Adams end up falling into the category of a player who gets paid a whole bunch and then everything starts to go wrong? You know, he gets hurt, you know, like nagging injury kind of stuff. You know, something drops off in productivity. You're not getting what you expect. And you just kind of get locked in then for the next 3 years because of the guarantees on the deal, and you end up with an expensive paperweight. So I think that's the next part of it, because you already lost part one. Part one of the trade was Jamal Adams needed to get you at least to the championship game last year. He had to make somehow that type of difference. He didn't. So that already the trade was a failure. Now the thing is, does it get worse on an extension, or does he help the defense kind of maintain at least a decent status to where over the remainder of Russell Wilson's career with the Seahawks, you know, or what we know will definitely be his career with the Seahawks, they can continue to win divisions, be in the playoffs, and have that opportunity to get, you know, to that championship game and possibly get back to the Super Bowl. So I guess that's where you look at that as we move forward here. So, I think we'll get some more clarity on that this week. So the thing I really wanted to talk about this week actually had to do, though, with quarterbacks. So now that the Josh Allen deal was done, you start talking about how much money he's making, you know, $43 million a year. And then you start looking at the Cleveland Browns, and you look at the Baltimore Ravens, and people are looking now at the, you know, looking back at the Kansas City Chiefs, and you're seeing the money that's going to some of the quarterbacks. And you start getting some of those same questions I see popping up, like, now what do we do with the team? It's like, now we've put ourselves into a bind because we've got this big expensive quarterback on the team. And, you know, I don't understand where that logic kind of comes from. The expensive quarterback on the team is perfectly fine in the NFL. The way the salary structure works in the league right now, there's not a negative. You don't put yourself into a negative situation by having an expensive quarterback. You know, just shooting off the top of my head here, you got Mahomes at 45. You've got Allen at 43. You have Prescott at 40. Watson's at 38. Rodgers is 35. Wilson's 35. Rodgers probably 33. Goff is right around there. Wentz, you know, now their effective values are lower because they've been traded. Kirk Cousins is at 33. So basically the point is that there's a lot of quarterbacks right around 40. And then the generation before, you have a lot of quarterbacks right around 35. As you see some of those names, you go, well, yeah, some of those names suck. And sucks maybe isn't the right word, but you know, they're not like high caliber players. Like, is Goff a high caliber player? No. Is Wentz a high caliber player? No. Is Cousins a high caliber player? No. Are they passable? Yeah, they're probably passable players. Cousins certainly a passable player, but they're not great players. But the thing is, if you have a starting quarterback, you extend said starting quarterback, they all make basically the same amount of money. You know, it's whatever the range is in the year that they sign, everybody makes that amount of money. So when you do have a good quarterback, and I'm not saying that Josh Allen will or will not be, just that when you do have a good quarterback, there is no downside to signing him to a big contract. And there's two reasons for that. Reason number one is the fact that they're so much better than everybody else, that they're so important to the outcome of a football game, right? That, you know, your seasons pretty much hinge on the play of the quarterback. You're not putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage to any other team in the NFL that has a veteran quarterback, because every player earns about the same amount of money. If Josh Allen, no matter what, you're going to pay Josh Allen around $40 million a year. So the question just becomes now of this group of players, and we'll include Jackson and Mayfield in there because they're going to all be in that same category. If Josh Allen plays at a level to where you are a borderline Pro Bowl player, and I'm talking about a Pro Bowl based on merit, not a Pro Bowl based on name value. You know, if you're like one of those top six quarterbacks or so in the league, you know, and you're in the discussion for that every year, you're perfectly fine. Because who is it more of a disadvantage? Let's say you're in that category, and let's say Baker Mayfield ends up being the Kirk Cousins style category. So who's at a competitive disadvantage there? Is it you as the Buffalo Bills for having Josh Allen, who's close to that Pro Bowl level all the time? Or is it for having Baker Mayfield, who becomes more of kind of a game manager that just happens to be making the same amount of money? So you're not at a competitive disadvantage because every other team that is a veteran quarterback is in that same salary range. Reason number two, the market does evolve for quarterbacks. When you sign these long-term deals, as the Buffalo Bills did with Josh Allen, now this might be different for Dallas with Dak Prescott, who's on the four-year kind of contract. But notice how when I broke those into two buckets, you had a bunch of guys in like that 40-ish million range, and then a bunch of guys in that 35 million range. Basically, the market itself resets, you know, kind of every 2 to 3 years. When you lock your guy in for 40 something now, let's even just say it was a competitive disadvantage for you. It's only a disadvantage for 2-3 years, because by then what happens is the next crop of quarterbacks comes up and they expand on what you did in the market. You're sitting there at 43, 2-3 years from now, you're going to have a group of four players sitting there around 50. So who's in better shape at that point in time? Now, it may depend a little bit on how you manage your salary cap. May depend a little bit on what your budget is and how you broke down your contract. But just in terms of overall pay, it's only an advantage or a disadvantage that exists for a very short period of time. You know, when you go back to the class of 2004, which was really the last great quarterback class, when you go back to that, one of the big things that I think helped the Steelers be successful for a long period of time, the Chargers do pretty well. The Giants, you know, did get a second Super Bowl in there, were competitive for a little bit of time before the wheels kind of fell off. The deals that they signed for those quarterbacks, which were all very high number deals at the time, you know, Eli Manning at 16, Roethlisberger probably around 14, Rivers probably around 15, maybe 14, 5, 15. But those deals, which were all high watermarks, really were only those high watermarks for like 2 years, and they were all 6-year deals. By the end of those contracts, those players weren't that expensive. It's a situation where the only disadvantage that exists because the quarterback isn't good, and you kind of fell into the trap of extending the player anyway. Are you at a disadvantage from a young football team? Yeah, you could be. It's not as big of a disadvantage as you think, and I think that's more because of the lack of confidence sometimes by some of the teams that go out there with young football players, and talk about that in a second here, just in terms of roster planning and everything else. The difference in pay is huge. You know, the top pick in the draft is going to earn somewhere in the ballpark right now of like $9 million a year. You're talking about players who are earning $40 million a year. So you look at that, and on its face, you would say, okay, I have an extra $30 million a year to spend on my team. Absolutely true. You do. Not enough teams approach that right, because when you run the numbers for it, which I did, and you kind of break things down into a little bit longer period of time, the actual difference in spending that occurs between the expensive quarterbacks and the rookie quarterback classes is probably, it's around 10 to maybe $12 or $13 million a year. So it's nowhere near as big as the on-paper gap that you see of the $30 million. And I think that happens for a couple of reasons. One is, and this is where the people come in and say, well, what are you going to do now that Josh Allen is making so much money? The Indianapolis scenario, where you go back to when they were going to extend Andrew Luck, and they finally did extend Andrew Luck to a deal that was, I don't know, worth maybe $24, $25 million a season. You know, and Ryan Grigson, who you already kind of knew from watching the way they built that roster, that it was basically a one-man show there, and the general manager was more of a byproduct of the Colts, Curtis Paintering themselves into Andrew Luck than anything else. But it was basically like, man, we signed this guy to a big deal. Things change. The only thing that really changed is just that you can't have like a really bad disaster draft, or, you know, you can't maybe take a risk on a free agent. But I think what you saw there was they were already in the planning stages of an extension for a quarterback, ended up kind of holding off maybe on really doing the best that they could with that roster while Andrew Luck was a rookie, because in the back of their mind, it was, man, Andrew Luck's going to cost us so much money that we need to hold off during his rookie years on spending so we have a way to cover his cost when he's a more expensive player. That's a disaster. That's not the way that you want to approach it, but I think a lot of teams do. And I think a lot of teams wait, they take a wait and see attitude with their young quarterbacks before they really do the stuff that's needed to be done to have a competitive roster. With the veteran quarterback making 40, if you have that kind of attitude for the teams with the young quarterbacks, you know, right now that's the Bengals, the Dolphins, the Jets, the 49ers, the Bears, I guess, sort of, the Jaguars, you know, those teams, you don't get as much of a disadvantage if they all approach it in, I guess, what would be that kind of traditional sense. That's something that we look at from the outside and we see that big discrepancy in salary and say, wow, that's such a competitive advantage. But then when you look in practice, and it's really not, and I think this is just a general observation of mistakes that teams make when they handle the rookie quarterback. A lot of times, as fans, as people who write about the sport, people talk about it, people do little bits of research on it, a lot of times what we focus on are the good results, right? We focus on the good. You know, how did the Patriots become a dynasty? How are the Chiefs good year after year? You know, how does this team, how do the Ravens do so well all the time? What is it that sets those teams apart that makes them so good? But there's also things that we can learn from really bad football teams, and not just about how not to do it, but how things could possibly be done. Where we talk about salary cap or money situations and having the ability to remain fluid with your roster construction so you can keep having talent in, talent out, talent in, talent out. If you look at a team like the New York Jets, all right, now I'll talk about the Jets because I'm so familiar with them. The New York Jets, who have been god-awful for a decade, what was something that you would say about the Jets if you were a Jets fan? It's a never-ending rebuild, right? What would happen? 2015, the Jets basically went in on a rebuild, and they went in, they spent a bunch of money, they signed some free agents, and they signed players to big contracts. They stuck, they blew up, it was terrible, whatever. What happens in 2017? Well, no, rebuild number two. Sign a bunch of big contracts again, new guys, new faces, couple extensions, bring in, you know, the players that you want over that period. Well, they stunk again. What happens in 2019? Yeah, we're rebuilding again. We go out and we sign CJ Mosley and Le'Veon Bell and all these players. Well, that didn't work out. What happened in 2021? Kind of back on the rebuild. Now, the Jets didn't do as much as I thought they were going to do this year, but Carl Lawson, Cordavis, you know, a couple of different players and you spend a lot of money. Okay, so now you laugh about that and go, ah, oh, well, that just tells you free agency is stupid. Okay, you know, and that the Jets are really poorly managed. I agree. Don't disagree with any of that. But the important thing there is what do you see? And what you should see is 2015, 2017, 2019, 2021. And that means as bad as you could possibly be as a front office, as bad of possible contracts that you could hand out to another, to a player that's a free agent, or in some rare cases, the Jets had players to extend. As bad as you could possibly do, as bad as you could manage your situation, you were able to turn over your roster every 2 years to fool the fans and ownership into thinking that you were building another competitive product and that this time it was going to be different. It helped McKagan stay in power for a pretty long period of time. And that's an important thing. It's an important lesson, because when you have a rookie quarterback and you have this window of opportunity to compete, it's not a very big window where you could, in theory and should, have a competitive advantage over other teams, you know, that do have that veteran quarterback, because you should be able to load up your roster with more talent. It's a 4 to 5 year window is really what it is. You know, it's the first 4 years of the rookie deal where the salary cap numbers are all low and the salaries are low. And then the fifth year where you get into the option where the salary cap number is high, or higher. It's kind of like a middle range. It's kind of in between your rookie level and what now is your like $40 million level. You know, basically it's going to be probably around, unless it's a super, superstar like, you know, Jackson was with all the Pro Bowls and stuff, where he comes in, I think at 28, I think Allen was at 23. So basically probably right around $23 million, you know, in today's NFL. But most of the time you're going to extend those players usually. So you're going to bring that salary cap hit lower in that first year, maybe even the next year. So you might even be able to look at it as a 6 year window. But I think for most, you would look at it as a 5 year window with the rookie control where you're kind of doing that stuff. But the way so many teams approach it is they look at year number one and they go, well, year number one is going to be a disaster. You know, the rookie quarterback's never going to do that good. And we need to evaluate where he's going to be and let's see where he's at and what we're going to do. And then you get into year two and you still don't know if the guy's great, not great. You don't really know. So what you do is you go in there and you do add to the team. Don't get me wrong. You're adding to the team, but you're probably not completely adding, because in the back of your mind, you're still kind of thinking, yeah, there might be some questions still here. Then year three comes around, you know, you've got the guy. Now you're in gung ho. You're like, all right, yeah, now I'm going to go and spend. Then I'm going to spend. Then you go, well, but I'm going to hold back a little bit because I'm going to have to extend him after this year or the next year. So I might hold just a little bit back, but you know, we'll do what we can. And then next thing you know, you've got the big quarterback contract and it's like, well, now I got to purge the roster. I think what we really should be doing as an organization is looking at these things as little windows of opportunity. And the way that I would look at this is, all right, so let's say that I have one of these quarterbacks here. That's a top pick. You know, he's the number one pick. I already know year one, I'm not going to probably learn too much about him. The only thing I might learn is if he's going to be like a Jamarcus Russell level, just disaster. Other than that, I'm probably not going to learn too much. Why don't we go out? Why don't we surround that player with as much talent as possible, below as much of our salary cap space as possible? Use as much of that as we can to build a team, but do it smartly. Don't get into all these five-year deals. Do a bunch of three-year contracts where you really only guarantee 1 year or at the most 2 years. You know, get some financial flexibility with that. And know for a fact that year one, you're going to be able to have a competitive roster, as competitive as you could be, around that rookie player. Then in year two, you're still going to have those decent pieces in place, hopefully, you know, if they work out. You probably have still a little flexibility to cut some of them and, you know, bring in some new talent the next year if you want to. But the thing is, you'll have it there for year one, year two. By year two, end of year two, you know what your quarterback is or is not, more often than not. You know, Josh Allen would be an exception to that, but you know more often than not who your quarterback is or isn't. You have a good feeling, you know, in most of these situations, you're talking about a rookie front office. You're talking about a rookie head coach. You know, most of the time you only get one shot in this. So often it's not a veteran team coming in, even if it's a new group. You've got that year, those 2 years to really evaluate your franchise, evaluate your new picks that you brought in, evaluate your free agents, And now you've got the ability, you definitely have the ability, salary cap wise, in the third year of the rookie contract, before you have to extend him, to be able to go in and do it again. Okay, this is where we made mistakes the first time. Those players are gone. Some of those guys worked out and they're only on three-year deals. We can extend them. We go back into free agency. We quote unquote rebuild again, where you're bringing in as many good players as possible. And, you know, you have that assumption that your quarterback is good. And you just put in the back of your mind, you know what? You're just going to make this policy. You're not going to extend your quarterback until year five. You don't have to have that gun to your head of thinking, well, you know, I'm going to have to make a $70 million signing bonus payment over the next 18 months and this, that, and the other thing. And what you're doing is you're really increasing this window of opportunity to where teams now, you get of those 4 years, you only get like a two-year period where you're kind of trying to exploit that advantage of having the low-cost quarterback when you should be having it over a four-year period. So you do it this way, you've got the advantage in year one, even if it's not going to pay off to anything more than 7, 8, 9 wins. You're ready to rock and roll in year two when, in theory, you should be a Super Bowl contender if your rookie quarterback is the real deal. So you need to have that team around him. And now, if your quarterback is the real deal, you've got the ability to go back in there in year three and start it all over, bring in new players, new talent, get younger, get faster, get whatever you need to keep that cycle going. And you have the money, you should have the money to spend to do that. In that sense, you can do it for the first two, you can do it for the last two, and then that rookie quarterback contract comes due, and you shouldn't be as concerned with that because you've already got the pieces in place, you already paid them, that's all taken care of. Hopefully your draft classes have worked out, you've got new young talent that you drafted that's cheap that you're going to pair with that rookie quarterback. That's the way that, you know, you should have this ability to spend $20 to $30 million a year more in terms of talent on the team than these other teams that have veteran quarterbacks. But teams aren't doing it. So it doesn't create the disadvantage for the team with the expensive quarterbacks, and it doesn't create the advantage for the teams with the lower cost quarterbacks because they're not maximizing it. So instead of maximizing over a four-year period, maybe you see them maximize over two. They take one shot at it when you should be taking at least two. And if you took it two times, I think you would see, if we ran those same kind of spending charts that I've done in the past, you would see that the teams that do spend $40 million on a quarterback would actually have a potentially inferior roster, like far inferior roster to the teams with a rookie. But the teams with the rookies are, right now, they're too cautiously optimistic. So those numbers come out more like $10, $12, $15 million instead of $30. Yeah, I think one of the other problems too is that too many of the young football teams with the young quarterbacks, I shouldn't say young football teams, but young quarterback teams, they spend too much money on backup quarterbacks. You know, every team should be trying to develop, you know, a lower draft pick quarterback, I think, all the time, because there's upside in that. There's no upside in Joe Flacco. There's no upside in Andy Dalton. There's no upside in that type of player. There are teams that have to bring in a quarterback like that. You know, I understand why Denver thought they could compete with Joe Flacco. I understand why Chicago thought they needed a player like Andy Dalton and they thought they could compete with them. But there's no comparison. Those players, their days are pretty much done. You know, you end up sometimes overpaying for those players, which also cuts into your ability to get a more expensive roster. And that's one of the other issues that we do see with a lot of the teams. Instead of developing, you know, I think most teams probably should look at a roster instead of a 53-man roster. You should look at it as a 52. You should always look at your team as a 52-man team with a third, what they used to call the emergency quarterback. You should just look at it as a roster spot that you're always going to have for developing someone as a quarterback. You know, if you have someone on your active roster, I think you become more invested in them than if they're a practice squad player. You know, you have more reason, more desire to do that. But one of the things is that you should always be developing your backup quarterback, who maybe could be your starter as well, you know, when you have a younger player. But you should want to develop an actual program to have a backup quarterback rather than falling into the trap of signing Andy Dalton. And that's not to pick on Dalton. It's just that, you know, look at Dallas last year. Prescott went down. Look at how bad things went. And I said that the Dalton signing, which wasn't expensive for Dallas last year, was a good signing for them. You look at Prescott going down, that offense went from 40 a game to, you know, 10. They could have done 10 a game with anybody. You know, maybe it wasn't 10, 17. I don't know. It was not a high-powered machine. Let's put it that way. You know, you should be developing young players as backups. One, they're cheap. Number two, they have upside. How low the draft pick has to be, I don't know. If it was me, I'm spending those number ones until you get it right. But, you know, if it's got to be a two, if it's got to be a three, use a two or a three. At worst, develop as a backup. If they happen to start, you know, and they play well, you know, that's wonderful. Having a low-priced backup that you can develop and tailor to your system is better than, you know, spending $5, $6, $7 million on Ryan Fitzpatrick. But, you know, that's just the way that teams approach it. I don't think the way that teams approach it really works towards building out the most effective roster and taking advantage of the fact that you have access to this dirt cheap quarterback who's going to start for you and possibly be a star for a 4-year period of time. That takes away any type of advantage you possibly could have in trying to kind of game free agency to the best of your ability to compete with those teams that do have the proven quarterbacks who are great. That's why when you do sign your Josh Allens for $40 million a year, you shouldn't be looking at it as a crutch. You shouldn't look at it as like a negative. You shouldn't look at it as like a, what are we going to do now, you know, kind of moment. You just look at it and go, you know, we just have to make sure as a front office we're a little bit better than before. We can't completely whiff on a first, or we can't completely whiff on this free agent. And maybe we can have a small, you know, a small mistake here and there, but, you know, we can't sign someone to a $15 million a year contract who barely ever plays for us. You know, you can't have that kind of mistake. You know, it just doesn't create the disadvantage that people think when a player signs that big deal, unless they end up just not being good. You know, if they end up being like Carson Wentz, then yeah, it's a mistake. They end up preventing you from building the team that really needs to compete with the great quarterback. That's a problem. But that's not a money problem. That was a personnel problem, and that was your inability to distinguish between a great quarterback and someone who happens to be your starting quarterback. And, you know, that's just what a quarterback costs. But every team does it. The only team that didn't do it is Washington with Cousins. That's the only team. You know, people say Prescott, but, you know, even Prescott being on the tag 1 year is no different than being on an option. You know, it was as if he was a first round pick. So yeah, it wasn't even really that. You know, Cousins was the only one because Cousins got the two franchise tags. And then actually hit free agency, you know, and that's really it when it comes to that. But yeah, I think that it would be for these teams that have these young quarterbacks, I think it would be really interesting to see if they could build their teams in a very different manner, you know, to really take advantage of that window of opportunity, kind of explode on the spending and explode in free agency on the type of players they could bring in, knowing that a lot of those players they bring in, it's probably going to be looked at as a mistake, but you're going to be able to turn them over anyway. And I think they just missed the boat on that. So real quick, just on the preseason, yeah, this was just watching the game the other night with a lot of punts. This is the Patriots game on like fourth and short. And my take is I don't get why teams in those situations are punting. A lot of people agreed and a lot of people disagreed. And the disagreements were for two things. So I just wanted to explain a little bit more what I'm talking about. I think in general, most people are of the opinion that NFL teams should be more aggressive because the potential positive outcome outweighs the potential negative outcomes. The hesitancy on a lot of the NFL to pick up on that is really because most of it is theoretical. You know, where you talk about EPA models and, you know, all kinds of different stuff like that. A lot of it's theoretical. You know, we don't see it in practice. We're not there to say that, you know, this guy might get fired. This guy might not get fired. You know, look, a blown call replay or whatever, you know, in the past, you know, when you didn't have replay, it might cost the head coach a job. You're talking about a play. That's always in the back of the mind of the head coach, number one. Number two, it's how reliable is that stuff? If I'm giving the ball to my opponent on the 30 every on my own 30 every time, I'm going to fall behind really fast. I can't say that that's not the case. I don't think it would be. But the reason I think for using these things in the preseason isn't because you're quote unquote giving away your best plays. You don't want to give away your best plays. It's kind of a silly thing, but you know, you don't want to give up that you don't want to see if a bunch of backups can convert on fourth down. I look at it more from a game strategy process of, in practice, being able to see what happens if I do go for it on fourth down, my guys don't convert, and I'm constantly giving the ball to the other team deeper and deeper into my territory, midfield, wherever it might be. How bad are those outcomes turning out? And it doesn't matter if it's the preseason, and it doesn't matter if it's against backups. It's backup on backup crime, basically. You're seeing how these games can evolve. Does it completely go out of control? You know, you're playing the game. Let's just say that you were the Patriots and you tried that. And let's say three times in a row, Mac Jones doesn't convert. Unable to do it. All right. So one, yeah, maybe your fourth down stuff didn't work great. Who cares? Did you fall behind 21-0? Did you fall behind 14-0? Did you fall behind 10-0, 9-0, 3-0? Is it still 0-0? I think people need to see this stuff happen in real time before they'll really give any kind of credence to it or any kind of thought to actually implementing it into a game or as something that would be a much bigger game strategy than, you know, just going for it on the occasional fourth down or when things are late in the game and you just don't have a choice. You know, you might pick up a bunch of fourth downs too, and maybe that will give you more confidence. But I think it's more about evaluating what happens after those plays. If I do convert on fourth down, is my offense a little bit capable of still moving the football? You know, or does it just lead to yet another fourth and does it lead to a fourth and long that, you know, has no chance? How many more yards do I really need to pick up to get a field goal attempt? Got these kickers with these bigger and bigger legs. You know, how far do you really need to get? Maybe just one more first down after that, two more first downs, depending on where you are. And then, like I said, the big one, I think the big takeaway is what does the other team do with the ball after they get it? And I think you can evaluate that stuff even in the preseason. So that's one of the things. Number two, I think it is more important to get your team's work on the offensive side of the football, maybe even on the defensive side. Now, I know we don't play the starters pretty much at all anymore, but in a league where people get hurt all the time, especially this year where you're talking about 17 games versus 16, an extra game of nagging injuries and getting banged up and stuff like that, maybe planned rests for certain players. You want to have more confidence in players that you can bring them in, you know, and insert them in with your, you know, traditional rotation guys on offense and defense too, I guess. But I'd rather see them get work. Because in the practices now, you just don't have as much time to do it, as much time to get those guys to kind of stand out. So I think I'd rather see that there. Now, the other side of the argument, and this is valid too, is that the path for a lot of players to make a team is special teams. So in many cases, it's more important to watch, you know, a punt play. Maybe it's a little bit more important to watch a kick return, punt return, whatever it might be, than it is to watch your offense on fourth down. Now, my goal would be to get the players more overall reps, not just fourth down. But, well, I'm not going to completely discount the role of the special teams, obviously, you know, and how much energy some of these guys will bring in a game situation, you know, especially if practice is toned down a little bit. The one thing I will say is that special teams is becoming less and less of an important factor, I think, in the NFL. The NFL is basically legislating out kickoff plays, so that is of far, far, far less importance than ever in the past. Your punt plays, yeah, they're important, but I think you're going to see over time teams punt less. I do think as well, you do have a lot of punters that have a leg. Yeah, you can just kick the ball out of the end zone. Maybe the coffin corner stuff is thing of the past. You know, I don't know. I don't think it plays as big of a role anymore as it used to. Maybe in our minds it does. I think in the grand scheme of things, and again, yeah, I don't disagree that it's a path for players to potentially stand out. But when you're never playing starters in a preseason, your goal really should be to stand out, you know, offense, defense, I think much more so than specials. You know, it's a little bit different, I would think, and maybe there's people that'll say that that's wrong, but there's a difference, I would think, in the past in the NFL where you played your starters until the mid-third quarter of the first three playoff games, for example. You know, you played your starters until mid third quarter, and then, you know, you kind of put your backup guys in there. Now you're playing your guys for like a series, you know, if that. Most of the time it is your backups and your third string guys that are playing, you know, all of your regular football downs. So, you know, if you're going to stand out, I would rather try to stand out offense, defense, you know, to where the coaches would have confidence that they can inject me into a game at any given moment, you know, than really standing out as a special teamer. The limited sets of opportunities there as well. So I would rather see that. And I think as a coach, I would probably rather evaluate that. You know, it's just there's way more importance on the offensive side of the football and, you know, somewhat the defensive side of the football too, I think, than just evaluating the special teams play. Again, you know, it's not to say that you don't want to see the effort. You don't want to see if those players really can stand out, if they have instincts to, you know, really get down there and stop a guy on a punt return, all that kind of stuff. There's a role for it. It's not like there's no role. I just think it's of less and less and less importance. I think with teams getting younger and younger and younger all the time, there is more of a path to being able to stand out as a potential player than there is just as a special teamer who a team is going to develop over the next couple of years, and then they can grow into something more. I feel as if that's kind of a lost part of the NFL, you know, where that definitely exists in the past. Your goal, your role to make the team was as a special teams guy, you know, and then you develop more into a all-around player, and then eventually you found your way into rotations, offense, defense, and a lot of times, you know, getting a nice little extension as an actual contributor on offense or defense. Nowadays, I kind of feel like a lot of that is just kind of spit out. You're just, oh, that guy's a special teams guy. That's it. You don't waste the time, take the time to develop them as to anything else. Yeah, and there's exceptions to that. You know, there's players who, you know, have stood out on specials, and then they've probably more on the defensive side become important or more important defenders. You know, and then you'll see their special teams play will go way down. You know, their playing time, they won't really get used in those packages anymore because they become more integral to the overall group. I think I'd rather just stand out offense, defense, because I'm going to get more opportunities now since I'm playing four quarters, you know, with the backup kind of players in there to do that. My bigger thing really is just trying to get more confidence as a coach in the way different situations might shake out based on the result of a fourth down play, just so I can see it in practice. And maybe that gives me the confidence to believe what somebody's telling me. Or, you know, maybe if what we're saying on some of the fourth down stuff is completely wrong, you know, you take that the other direction, it gives you the ability to go and question a little bit more the methodologies that exist. And you improve on that. But I understand why teams aren't going to test things out in the regular season. Why not test them out in the preseason? You know, they're meaningless games. You know, bring some meaning to the meaningless aspect of the games. And I would just look at that. So anyway, that was just something I thought it was a kind of a little bit of an interesting topic. So let's just take a look at the Twitter questions, and then we'll wrap this one up here. I don't think I had any emails this week. Hopefully I didn't miss anything. I just a quick search, didn't see anything. All right. Connor says, what reference do you use for official NFL transactions? I found NFL.com. They have missing transactions. Of course, Alex Pup, NFI, COVID. Google search hasn't revealed. So you can, if you're a media member, you should be able to get access to the NFL media sites. Basically, we'll publish a public version of the transaction wire. Other thing you can do if that ever vanishes, you can basically team by team. They typically will have a pretty full list of transactions that come down. They just don't put them on NFL.com. But if you filter down to the individual team transaction lines, a lot of times they have all the stuff on there. Costa says, with right tackle approaching left tackle and APY at the top of the market, Bears signing Jason Peters, is it reasonable that the Bears keep Tevin Jenkins at right tackle? He was a true first-round talent at right tackle. And while he does have experience at left side, do you want to give a rookie tackle more to adjust to? So I think, you know, if their goal is to play Peters at left tackle, I think that's fine. I don't think that you want to keep Jenkins at right tackle. I don't think that would be the plan. But I do think that it is hard sometimes to transition the player that quickly. You might not be able to transition at all. I would say the right way to do it is probably this. And this is what a lot of teams do with younger players. They'll start them on the right side see how things go. And then the plan would be to move him to the left side next year. But, you know, plans can change. You may find next year that you're in a position to draft a left tackle. Now they don't have a first rounder next year, but you may see they had to trade that for Fields. You know, you may see that you're in a position to draft a left tackle. So that gives you your quote unquote super tackle group. You may have a left tackle that you see in free agency who you really like. So I think this is probably the right way if Peters can be healthy to develop that. But I think in the back of your mind right now, you would be thinking he'll be your left tackle of the future, but it makes more sense to run with it this way right now and then see where things go. Regarding Seahawks restructuring Wilson to be able to sign others, there were many comments Wilson doesn't have to agree and others on the other side that he has to. You brought this up in the past that restructures are negotiated and already in the contract. Clear that up once more. So yeah, so when players say that they're willing to restructure for the benefit of the team, the player has absolutely no say in that. 99 times out of 100, and it's definitely the case with Russell Wilson. So when that became a story on Pro Football Talk, I immediately said, why is this a story? The player agreed to this renegotiation at any point in time in the life of their contract when they signed that deal. So if Wilson signed his deal in 2019, I think that's when it was, he agreed at that point in time that the Seahawks have the right to convert his salary to a bonus for salary cap purposes at any point in time in 2019, at any point in time in 2020, at any point in time in 21, 22, 23. They can't add on void years and stuff like that without his consent, but they can convert whatever salary they feel like to a signing bonus, and he has to sign, you know, basically just the paperwork on it just so they can file it as the legal binding thing. That was all agreed to. So anyone that says that, and, you know, a lot of times these players believe it, and I think they don't even know what they don't have enough of a knowledge just on that side as to how it works. You know, thinking that you're deferring money to the future, that you'll get paid, you know, it doesn't work that way. Everything basically stays the same within the contract. The only thing is that it gives you more protection in terms of dead money with your contract in the future. It gives you more leverage because of your salary cap numbers on an extension. If you look at Philadelphia and you look at some of the contracts there, like Lane Johnson, Brandon Brooks, a lot of those deals, I think, have come down because of the excessive use of the restructure provisions within those contracts. It put them in positions to where they had to extend those players early, in part because of salary cap circumstances. As a player, you should always want your contract restructured like that. Always. Always, always, always. But it's not your ability to say, hey, Seattle, look, I'm here willing to play ball. I'll do it for the good of the team. It's Seattle's decision the whole time. And that holds true for every single player in the league. High Times Vikes, what could a Harrison Smith look like? And then he clarifies an extension look like. You know, I would guess probably around what he's at $10 million a year now. I would guess 3-year deal, maybe same. You know, I forgot about Devin McCourty. So I would guess he's probably going to aim for 12 a year. You know, 2-3-year deal. I was thinking of Logan Ryan at 10-25 or whatever. So probably in that ballpark is what he'd be looking to receive. But I'm not sure. I don't really have a good feel on him at all. But safety is kind of a weird spot. All right, let's see. Seahawks fan says, void years for dummies. Can you explain it very simply? I guess so. I mean, basically, what you're allowed in the NFL, you're allowed to take a signing bonus and prorate it over 5 years of the contract. That's the maximum amount of time that you can prorate that bonus money. A lot of times contracts don't run 5 years. They're 3 years, 2 years, 4 years. You know, you restructure a deal, there's only 2 years left. So in order to be able to prorate the money over 5 years to get your maximum salary cap flexibility, what you do is you tack on these years, which are called void years. So the player will agree to it because it doesn't impact their ability to get into free agency again. It's just adding on basically dummy years where you can dump salary cap charges that you'll pay for at a later time. So basically what you're doing is it's a team decision to defer salary cap to the future. You have to do it in a way where the player's contract is extended. So by rule, you're allowed to prorate it over time, but you're not really changing the effective term of the contract. So what you do is you put in a void provision that the contract itself, if the player is on the roster on a certain date, the contract voids. It's just a kind of a loophole to get around the rules. But basically, it's just a way to dump salary cap in the future so you can maximize your chances now. John asks, why haven't the Bears cut Jimmy Graham? That is one of the mysteries, you know, of the world. I have no idea how he's still on the team this year. That makes no sense whatsoever. But he's there. All right. Friendly Big Dumb Boy. Could you give a rough estimate in a vacuum what free agency deals are required to trigger the difference in third, fourth, fifth round comp picks? For example, imagine that a 15, 30 guaranteed, 60 was demarcation where everything above is a third. Let's see if I can back into that. Nick would be the guy to go to for that. So I can give you a rough guide for this year. And obviously this changes year by year. So if we look, the third round picks ended with Bud Dupree, who was probably around 15. Carl Lawson was also around 15 million. So I'm going to guess that the basics are probably around 15 to 16 million was a third rounder. A fourth round pick this year looks to be around 11-ish. I would say your fifth rounders, Marvin Jones is at 6. So that one's probably a little bit more fluid. So I'm just going to guess as a rough guide, and this is really rough. And there's other things that come into this as well, as like playing time and stuff like that. I'm going to guess that anything over 15 right now probably projects to be a third. Maybe it's over 16 projects to be a third. Anything over 10 probably is a 4. Anything over maybe 6 is a 5. Maybe 7. Maybe anything over 7 is a 5. Probably 6 to 7. And again, depends on play time, is a 5. To get to a 6th round level, you're probably looking at a 2.5 or 3 million, maybe, is your point. And then a 7 would be, whatever is the minimum that qualifies these days on that, low 2s or something like that, 1.8 or so. Glex says, who are the top five most likely camp cuts who will be valuable to another team? I don't know if there's really going to be anybody. I think at this point in time, if a player gets cut, I don't think you're going to find that kind of value to another team. I mean, once in a blue moon that happens, I don't think you really see that anymore. Guys who get released and it's like, wow, I can't believe that they're out there and then they go and sign somewhere else. So I don't think there's really going to be anything that stands out. Jalen Smith and the Cowboys is going to go either this year or next, which makes more sense with the Cowboys. Well, he's not going to go this year. That's already taken care of. Let me see Smith's contract. I think his deal is hard to even move next year. So his dead money next year is 6.8. Okay. His salary will guarantee next year, fifth day of the league year. So that's probably the 20th. Yeah. Probably if he's on the roster on the 21st, his salary will probably vest for the season. So it's injury protected right now. So it'll depend on, if he gets hurt, obviously, or not. If they decide to move on, they could move on next year. He's got 6.8 dead. So you'll know in early March if that's going to be the case. My assumption is Dallas likes him. So my thought would actually be that if they want to bring something down, we'll see if he would be open to like a pay cut or something like that. I don't know if Dallas is really that disappointed with him. I think based on what Dallas would expect for him, I think he's probably kind of lived up to it. He's just not a standout player. But I don't think Dallas paid him to be a standout. I don't know. He's kind of an oddball one. It was not a good signing in terms of everything else Dallas had to do. I don't know if he's as much of a negative in the eyes of the front office as he is in the eyes of, I think, a lot of fans and people who discuss kind of the Cowboys stuff. Armin says, what cap casualties do you see before the season starts? Same thing. I don't really see anyone at this point as being a salary cap casualty. Might something happen, to some veteran? Yeah, I guess so. But I think at that point, the salary cap is used as a crutch more than it really is. WFT News, if Chase Young becomes the best non-quarterback in this game this year or next, how much would you expect Washington to re-sign him for and how much? So I think with Allen doing his deal after 3, I think that would set a stage for that, as a starting point. Now, obviously, he's not the highest paid interior in the NFL. He's like number 5, number 6. And here you'd be looking at someone who'd be the number 1. I would guess you would do it after the 3rd year, possibly the 4th. Money-wise, it's too early to say. It's going to depend a bit on where TJ Watt would come. But clearly $30 million a year The next milestone for pass rushers, 30 million a year. I just don't know if that'll be TJ Watt or somebody else. But that's the next milestone figure for a pass rusher. So I would imagine that would be the number. It's just a question of if TJ Watt gets to 30, and let's say Chase Young is just a complete monster 2 years from now, is that 33? You know, or have they been able to hold off on this 30 to where he becomes the first 30? You know, 30 becomes such a magical number that you get somebody to agree on the number 30. I don't know the answer to that. Just, you know, I'd wait to see where the market is, but at least 30 would be the number. Futurist, humanist, optimist. Is Justin Fields the best player in the history of the NFL? Second to Zach Wilson. That's where he's at. Nick DeRose, do you think Larry Fitzgerald will win a Super Bowl before he retires? No, I don't. I would think his career is done now. So I would guess the only way that that's a possibility is, let's say Arizona is great this year and they have a need at wide receiver, or they want to bring him in at some point, you know, and they sign him to kind of a token deal towards the end of the year to where he's on the team, you know, or maybe another team adds him mid-season. I don't anticipate at this stage of his career that he's going to be impactful towards a Super Bowl. The only way you would see him be in a position to win a Super Bowl is if he lands mid-season on a team that has a desperate need for a wide receiver, or the Cardinals, who might just do it as a, you know, we want to have you here during this, you know, kind of thing to where he has a chance. You know, his days of being that kind of player on those kind of teams, you know, where you would see that ahead of time, are pretty much done. So, and maybe that's a reason why, if there are actually some offers for him to keep playing, maybe that's one of the reasons why he hasn't signed yet, because it does make more sense for probably right now, you know, and he's had a tremendous career, you know, financially, just incredible. He can maybe pick and choose. So maybe if the Ravens come a calling for $2 million at some point in late October, you know, he would agree to it, and maybe he'll happen to be on the team that wins. But that's a lot different, I think, than being on a team right at the start of the season and being a big part of the reason why they get to the Super Bowl, which is where he was in his career in that period with Kurt Warner and Carson Palmer. You know, it'd be nice if he got to win a Super Bowl. Awesome player, probably didn't get even as much credit as he deserved for being as great as he was. And he really actually, you know, when I talk about being one of the giant winners in the business of football there, he probably could have been an even bigger one and chose not to, because I think he wanted to maximize the ability for the Cardinals to compete, as well as, you know, keep active within that organization. You know, and he probably could have held them for more, and he never did. Past that initial rookie deal, the one right after the rookie deal where he got the 16 and change on that deal, you know, I think he was actually pretty workable with the organization there. So I'd like to see him win, but I don't think that'll happen. So that does it for me. So I am going on vacation. Don't be surprised if OTC goes a little bit dark. You know, the transactions might be a little bit late, but I'll try to keep up with transactions, and we'll have that stuff all done. I know Troy is going to help out, and we'll get some stuff cleared up with that. If anything big does break, I will try to be active in some way, shape, or form online to do some stuff. I'll still be on Twitter, but there will not be a podcast next week. We're leaving on Friday, so I'm not going to be around, and there probably will not be one the following week as well. I'll see if I can do one, but you know, we're at that point, we start to get into the big massive cutdowns. You know, the timing again for when we get back is just going to be a little bit difficult for me to keep on that schedule. Probably most likely we'll be back right before the start of the regular season. I'll be back and, you know, try to do a little bit of a preview of the season. You know, and then as we make the turn into the fall, one, I know someone had asked the other week about doing like a big edge cornerback study. I was going to hope to do that this week, didn't get a chance with just other stuff that happened. So hopefully we'll do that early in during the season. And I think what we'll do during the season is we'll take a turn right away into looking at salary cap situations for teams for next year. Even though you don't necessarily have that eye on there, I think what we'll start with is free agency, because, you know, this is going to be it for extensions over these next 2 weeks. Is pretty much going to be it for the extensions coming down. So we can start to make that turn towards looking at free agency. We can start to do some positions. And then as we get a little bit more into the season and after 4 or 5 weeks, we start to see which teams are really struggling. We'll start to turn the focus onto the salary cap for that. So I think that's what we'll do this winter time, this fall and this winter with the podcast. And then we'll go full blast in free agency. And hopefully we'll have some stuff during the season that we'll be able to pop out there. We'll do the player evaluations again. You know, just like last year, I'm not sure if the first week will actually get done on time. I think I got those done on time last year. They probably won't be this year. I know some stuff I have to change around there, but we'll get to those in there as well. And hopefully we'll have some new looks for stuff that I know Nick is working on and some things that we'll have in there. So anyway, my emails will be open over the next 2 weeks or so. So I'll be able to answer stuff there and try to get some stuff there as well online. But yeah, we'll be a little bit dark on the podcast. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to everybody in 2 weeks or so. All right, take it easy, everyone. Bye.